Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast, where we explore energy, sustainability, and innovation in the oil and gas and energy businesses. So today we are joined by Nick Medina. He is a 33-year ExxonMobil veteran, has global experience in oil and gas operations across multiple continents. I think he just returned from one, hoping to hear about that. Nick's led some critical safety initiatives, including pipeline emergency response training program at Texas A&M that helps equip first responders with hands-on skills dealing with energy emergency situations like CO2 and others. His efforts earned industry recognition for advancing safety standards. So he's also the founding chair of the Tapia Center at Rice University. He promotes STEM education and has inspired thousands of students that engage in sustainable energy solutions like carbon capture and others. So, hey, Nick, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Adam. Glad to be here.
Definitely. And I also want to mention, we're missing Brian Nix today, but Stuart, how are we doing today? My co-host Stuart is on.
Yeah, doing well. Glad to be on here and looking forward to the conversation.
Good. Well, Nick, we usually start off the podcast with a little Let's Clear the Air so folks can get to know you. We're coming up on football season here, and me being in Texas, that's kind of a big deal. So the question everyone wants to know is, are you more of an NFL fan or an NCAA football fan?
Well, given that today I'm going to the opening season game for the Houston Cougars here in Houston, I'll tell you, NCAA all the way. I'm a big Cougs fan, right? And I think in the Big 12, Houston has a fairly good chance, and I'm rooting for, you know, pretty much everyone in the Cougar team to take us to that leadership, right? Exciting here in Houston when you talk about football, because it's been a while since the Cougars have been doing well. So I'm thrilled. I'll be hosting a group of about 20 folks today at the new wing of Tedeco Stadium. I got a suite for the family and 18 other guests. So I'm very excited that this season is kicking off.
Excellent. That sounds like a good time.
Yeah.
Well, Stuart, why don't you get us kicked off here?
Yeah, no, happy to. And I'll take the opportunity to say I'm a NCAA fan. So I went to Mississippi State. I think I've probably told everybody on the podcast that before. I like to talk about my alma mater, but went to Mississippi State. And so I'm excited for college football to start strongly in earnest this weekend. So looking forward to it. But Nick, you know, you and I have worked together. Adam shared a little bit about your bio from your bio. But maybe in your own words, tell us a little bit about your career, you know, what got you where you are and all those 33 years, what'd you do?
Hey, thank you, Stuart. You know, and a good chunk of those 33 years was really in the pipeline side. I would say I've been blessed to have an amazing career in the energy side, about a third in downstream, third in upstream, and the last third was in the midstream side, particularly the pipeline side. And that's where Stuart and I kind of got together, you know, in industry. But I've seen pretty much across the board the wonderful job that pipeline workers and energy workers do throughout the world. I spent about a third of my career abroad, right, in Latin America, in Europe, and then I cover the Middle East, Russia, right, and then I work in Alaska. And for the last 15 years, you know, I kind of really focus a lot into the pipeline side, right? I was called upon to help in an incident in Arkansas back in 2013 and fell in love with the side of energy that is about what we do on the ground. How do we earn respect from the communities in which we live? And how do we prepare for the unexpected, right? And making sure that we always put safety ahead of everything else. So I will tell you, wonderful career. It would have been 34 years this year. Right. I've been hinting to both all my colleagues and the company that this is something I wanted to do. I don't regret it. I think walking away at a peak of where I was the right thing to do. And I really feel privileged that as we look ahead, there are so many opportunities in which I can contribute. I mean, two of those opportunities is maintaining those relationships that I've built and developed over the years. You know, the relationship with first responders, it's something I take at heart, right? So I've been asked to join NASFM, National Association of State Fire Marshal, and really in a staff purpose, but helping the president and the board, right, on the strategies and how to relate to industry. So I'm Chief Nick, right, responsible for energy and industry and supporting the board and the NASFM leadership in how do we get, you know, a lot more of not just energy, but, you know, the EV industry, you know, the data center industry to put safety first and train first responders ahead of what is coming next. Right. And then in the other side, you know, I'm pleased to continue to give my time to Rice University Tapia Center, which for the last 10 years really has dedicated to help students and educators learn more about STEM. And in particular, the last three, we really focus on carbon management. So that's something that I take at heart. It was my way of paying it forward. I'm sure I'm going to keep busy in supporting those two organizations and a number of others that I continue to assist. But I mean, I'm a big believer. Listen, I've received quite a bit. It's time for me to give back, right? And that's really what I'm focuses on this next several years.
On a quick sidebar, you mentioned upstream, midstream, downstream. You know, we have a broad range of listeners, so can you give them some insight on some of the stuff you did just quickly on each of those, just so they kind of understand better the way that your company kind of looked at that?
Sure. Look, everything begins with finding, you know, resources and for that matter, oil and gas or anything related to taking it out of the ground, right? And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm a big believer in sustainability and making sure that we do things right for the environment. Definitely. This industry does a heck of a job in meeting the world's energy demand. I mean, look, the world is 8-9 billion people. There is only two that kind of enjoy the kind of resources that the world provides. There's six more others that are going to double the demand for energy in the next 30 to 40 years. That's just the truth. I don't have the heart to tell anybody in the third world country, you should not be riding a bike or an automobile because you got to still be in a bicycle. I can't do that. I mean, people want a refrigerator. The people want the standards of living, probably not as exaggerated as the ones that we live here in the Western world or in the U.S. because we're blessed with having the energy resources that we do. But they want the very basic minimum, having a light, having electricity to have some minimum standards of living. And that's just going to drive a lot of the energy demand for the next 30, 40 years, right? So the upstream is the one that has to find those. And I was really lucky to see how that works, whether it was, you know, getting into existing fields that have ample resources in the Middle East. You know, Upper Zakum 750 was an Abu Dhabi project that ExxonMobil was part of it. I was helping as the public affairs person in there. I remember when I was helping in Qatar, you know, leading it to become the world's largest exporter of LNG worldwide. It was a pleasure to work with Qataris in positioning what they were trying to make of their country and supplying the energy needs that the country needed at that time, right? I mean, amazing how the world comes together. But Alaska, I spent there a couple of years trying to see if we can revive that gas pipeline that keeps 40 years down the road trying to get started. Met with local indigenous groups, first Alaskans, you know, first Canadians, and how that could happen. The world needs energy, and we need responsible energy players that can get to those places. It's not easy. And I think one of the challenges that I have is making sure my kids understand this is not just plug and play, right? Download an app and you produce crude oil. That doesn't work like that, right? I mean, it's real hard work that takes a lot of science, a lot of engineering, a lot of hard work by folks 365, 24/7 to do so. So less that I've really got to see the side of upstream that is all about production, but in a responsible and safe way. Yeah. I can't tell you enough. It's you get a different type of respect when you see the commitment of those workers, of those operators that do it right. Right. The downstream, fasten your seatbelt. I did everything. I mean, I think the first few years of my career, when I was working in Latin America, I was selling And I was more worried about selling hot dogs at the convenience stores and, you know, selling fried chicken and building big stations, which at that time, 16 pounds was gigantic. Now you go, you know, into the ones that we have here in Texas, and I mean, that's nothing. But back in the days, you know, selling 2 million gallons a day was amazing. Okay, yeah. Now, I mean, it's kind of normal when you do this super gas stations that existed. But around the world, I had the privilege to manage the On the Run brand that ExxonMobil had for many years. We got retailer, convenience retailer chain of the year in 2004. And really enjoy when we were trying to introduce coffee, you know, the new black gold. I used to say to folks, hey, we make more money in one of those big Java cups of coffee in margin than we do selling that SUV all the way to the top, right? So it's a different kind of mentality. I think Big Oil played with the idea of convenience stores because it was the right thing to do. Here in the States was the Tiger Mart, right? And, you know, I remember going to the Cayman Islands and putting Tiger Markets together with the Esso logo, or going to Imperial, you know, or here in the United States, the Hungry Tiger, right? Across the streets, you know, put a tiger on your tank, but put a tiger on your stomach too. We're selling a lot of stuff that was completely untraditional to what we did, yeah. Right? But I also did, I mean, remember when pump stations were not as automated as they are today? Right. The method of payment, you know, it was all cash. You had to go inside the store and pay. It wasn't pay at the pump. I was part of the pay at the pump, you know, mobile at that time. And then ExxonMobil together introduced SpeedPass. I don't know if you recall it, you know, a little device that you put in your keychain and it automatically had your credit card authorization. You just wave it in front of the pump and you go. That was before card readers. Right. That was before all the stuff that we have today. Right. I got to live that. I mean, I got to enjoy that. I remember building car washes because the margin of car washes next to a gas station was a big deal, right? I knew more about the different models of car washes back then and what they did, right? And the behavior of consumers as they got to, you know, an On the Run or a Tiger Mart store, it was about the experience we were selling and the joy of retailing. We still meet those needs. But if you go back 20, 30 years ago, I mean, gas stations were just a little kiosk and you pay behind a, you know, now is an experience, right? Now you get more than that. You target the soccer moms about their needs. So I love that part of what I did because it made me close to the end consumer, right? And understanding the end consumer and their needs is key because, you know, there is a side of Big Oil that, you know, they explore, they produce, they put all their discipline and their safety practices in place, but they never see the end consumer. And yet my career began at the pump. What was the experience of people at the pump, right? And in many of the countries that I lived in, you know, we still have full service as the base. So getting that experience to be something that they prefer over another gas station was very, very important. So by the time that I came to midstream, I had that balance between the upstream and the downstream, and everything that connects those two is that set of pipelines and terminals in between. And you can't have it both ways unless you have that pipeline, you know, and we built a lot of pipelines in the last 7 or 8 years that I worked for the company, more than we probably did 30 years before. And it was because we had a boom. I mean, you recall the Permian wasn't that long ago. Fracking became popular, right? And suddenly we had this basin in the Permian Basin and we needed to build more pipelines. And I mean, that was formidable because by then I immediately said, we need to be close to those communities. We got to get the buy-in from landowners. We got to train first responders ahead of us putting that pipeline in place so they know exactly what to do, right? We got to earn their trust each and every day by our actions. And that culture is this engagement culture that wasn't there before, but that industry had learned to appreciate, because if we didn't, we're going to be spending more money on courts fighting for permits than we were about doing the right thing, yeah. Right? So I tell you, the last 10 years, I thoroughly enjoyed, you know, what I was able to combine from the upstream and the downstream and putting it in place in the midstream, which pipelines became kind of that linch point that would hold major projects down if you didn't have it in place. And I got to say, really also fell in love with the people in the midstream side. these are the folks that often get ignored because all the attention goes into the upstream, you know, and then the downstream takes it and produces everything that they do. But you couldn't have it any other way unless those people were there, you know. And I like to tell folks, look, in the downstream, you have the big refineries and you have big fences around there. Right. In the upstream, you have them offshore, you have them some far remote places where hardly any people live. So you really don't deal with communities. But the midstream pipelines run people's yards,
right,
run people's ranches, people's farms, people's parks. Right. We have to earn people's trust each and every day. It's a lot easier to say, hey, let's develop a community engagement plan for a refinery site. You know, you go 5 miles outside, 10 miles outside, let's say 20 miles outside, that's your circle, right? Upstream the same way. You look where your fields are, they're static. Pipelines, anybody who's in the pipeline business will tell you, we got thousands of miles that we have to earn people's trust.
Yeah.
And it's not just in a day. You know, you have to earn that trust, and it takes sometimes decades to establish a good reputation, and yet you can lose it in a matter of minutes. So making sure that not only, you know, your team, but the field folks understood the importance of why community engagement, why putting safety and making sure people realize that's what we do. We keep things safe, right? Makes a big difference. I think the work that we did with educators and students across our whole geography and then with first responders really sets us apart.
Yeah.
But I think all of industry really has taken a positive step in that direction.
Yeah. Nick, let's talk a little bit about that, the relationship with first responders. I mean, we'd love to hear a little bit more about what you did, especially with the universities there. But then also, you know, we've got some operators that listen. We'd love to hear. I know they'd love to hear some anecdotes and where you've seen success in building those relationships with those first responders.
Oh, look, in my career, you know, I've had to deal with circumstances where things go wrong, not because anybody plans for them, but you need to prepare and plan for them no matter what. You know, you have to deal with fatalities, you know, truck drivers that, you know, got hit and somebody died, and then going to the local, you know, family and tell them this is what happened, conduct a thorough investigation. You really get to understand that in what we do, there are consequences if it's not done correctly. And even when you do correctly, there might be third parties that impact what you do. So the importance of safety is, for anybody who's been in this industry, we know it is critical. There's no shortcuts. You got to do it right. And even when you do it right, you still need to prepare for something going wrong outside of your control. So, you know, May 29, 2013, I was heading to spring break. It was Good Friday, right? And that's when I got a call that I needed to go help, you know, the pipeline company on an incident that they had in Mayflower, Arkansas. It was a big pipeline that had a release. And I remember I told my wife, you know what, you just drop me at the airport here in a mile. I was almost getting to Austin, you know, and the airport is a little bit before you get downtown, right? And took a plane and arrived in Little Rock and then took a car and I went to Mayflower. First responders were the first people that were there. And it is because of their incredible work that incident was contained, even though I stayed there as the public information officer for almost 9 months. But those first few hours set the tone. And I remember meeting the local county judge, you know, Judge Dodson, right, who became later a great friend, right, and seeing how well he had coordinated, you know, the first few minutes to avoid really a bigger disaster. And then I spent time there meeting with community leaders and residents and, you know, apologizing. This was an incident that we fully regretted. But at the same time, we were committed to making sure that we left that place better than what we found it. Took 9 months. And let me tell you, we took a lot of heat. Even Hollywood stars dropping by to make a big case about their causes, you know. All we can do is, listen, we recognize something bad happened. We're going to make sure it doesn't happen. And we're going to learn from it. I'm going to share that so that everybody else also understands and can prevent it from happening again. But the importance of first responder became abundantly clear. So when we were in the midst of expanding, right, with a new set of pipelines for the Permian, I reached out to a number of elected officials and I said, hey, what can we do, right, to help prepare the environment? Again, planning ahead. Don't wait until there is opposition to develop a plan. Do it before there is any opposition, right? And they told us, train the first responders. And that's when I learned, look, 91% of all firefighters in the gray state of Texas are volunteers. That figure is similar across the country, particularly in rural areas, right? They get paid when they get the call to do something and they go to the stations and they punch. And on average, is between $10 to $11 to $12 an hour, right? Once they start responding. These folks need to know ahead, what are they going to deal with? So in our case, we wanted to train them in, listen, if it is hazardous liquids, I mean, what should you do? How should you prevent it from getting into a waterway? You know, what safety precautions you got to take? And so, in fact, one commissioner in San Antonio told me, you got to go talk to TEKS, the Texan Extension Engineering Service at A&M in College Station, in Bryan, actually. And try to see how you can come up with a training course that can target those folks. And the folks at A&M, together with the folks on NASFM, you know, folks like Phil Oakes that has been part of NASFM for so many years, we develop a curriculum for 2 days. These folks have a real job. So they give us a weekend, right? And they arrive on Friday night and they stay there all day Saturday, all day Sunday. Some of them leave that Sunday night or the next day. And it's tuition free, all room and meals paid for. And it is to prepare them in the very rare event that there is a need for them to know what to do and respond effectively. Right? I did that with Exxon for 8 years. We did about 24, 25 classes. They still have 4 years. And our plans with NASFM now is that we're going to host this for anybody in industry. So I know a number of my peers said, hey, we want to do this. It's not as simple because you got to get the machine going, right? You got to look at your routes. You got to identify where you have firefighters. You can see who has not taken the online training course and you want to emphasize for them, hey, we'll bring you to some locations and do that, right? Because you want to be very focused, right? I remember we did the first session and some folks from Canada say, hey, can I go take your course? I heard it's free. And I'm like, look, I got to take care of the folks that are near my routes first, right? And that's what the program is, right? But, you know, TEKS offers this to other folks too. So other folks can take it, right? The curriculum has always been industry's curriculum, right? It's the stuff that API and LIPA and INGA put together many years ago, right? And, you know, they keep, you know, updated in the online part of it. But one thing is about reading about what you should do in the event something goes off in a terminal or in a pipeline. Another thing is for you to put on your suit, simulate a real incident, try to prevent a spill, try to prevent a fire, get some real fires and get some real experience. The folks that do it, I mean, are phenomenal. TEKS is like a Disneyland for firefighters because they got all the props in the world, right? And I used to tell folks because they're like, oh, are you going to make him afraid? Because it just seemed like there's a big explosion. It's like, listen, if you take a kid to Disneyland and you don't let him take a ride, it's the same thing you take a firefighter to TEKS. You don't let him put out a fire. You gotta make him have that. Yeah. And what we learn is they truly appreciated that effort. You know, 3 years ago, the whole subject of CO2, you know, being transported in pipeline becomes a big deal. So we work with industry. We work with NASFM and TEKS and introduce a whole module on CO2. I mean, CO2 is incredibly safe. Transportation of CO2 has been going on for more than 50 years, and there's never been a fatality. Right, out of pipelines, right? And yet, the myth and all the rumors about it make it sound like this thing is going to explode. It doesn't explode. This thing is going to kill people. It has never killed anybody. Yes, it is a hazardous material, and you need to treat it with respect. But for the most part, in a pipeline situation, you just got to make sure that nobody around it, right, is impacted by it in a high-density concentration. Right. But it is really something that it's in every fire extinguisher, CO2. Right. Right. You go to a club, you know, that is raving and they suddenly blow away smoke. That's CO2. When college football kicks off, you know, today in full gear and you see those players coming out and you see all that smoke, that's CO2. Right. All the beer that you drink at stadiums will have CO2. It's something that we live. Yeah. We shouldn't be afraid of stuff like that, right? And recognize, yes, we have a responsibility. they were building a new pipeline, and he has CO2, train the firefighters that are nearby to know what to do, which is pretty simple, right? So I think the message, and, you know, industry has done a great job in making it out, you know, before you build something that the people don't know, right, make sure you train them. I'll give you one anecdote. All right. Firefighters, during all these trainings that we've been doing with them on hazardous liquids and gases, one time says, you know what we do when a Tesla catches on fire? And I said, well, what do you do? Well, the standard practice today is just let it burn. Yeah. Right? Because nobody came and told us you should use this material. Nobody came and said, hey, these are the standard practices. You just launch EVs, and it's not one company. It's pretty much anybody. Right? You got to let it burn because there's some fumes there that you don't want to have first responders getting their head into it or too close. Instead, just let it burn. Now we're starting to see the new products that cut the time that it burns, you know, from an hour to, let's say, 15 minutes. You're starting to see new products that, and everybody's jumping on board, okay, but shouldn't we have done this before? You know, but it's not a criticism. It's an observation. Yeah. Because progress also can be delayed. We wait to do everything, you know, absolutely 100% safe. We'd have never loaded an airplane or send a person to the moon. So it's a balance. But when he deals with the public, you got to do it safe, right? That's my view. So the relationship with first responder Stuart is really based on that we both share a mutual objective to protect the communities in which we live and operate. And the best way we do it is to prepare for the unexpected, no matter how remote and rare that those circumstances are. We have to be prepared. I get thrilled because with NASM, you know, Butch, the executive director, the president of NASM, I mean, he's big into the new technologies. I see a day that we will launch a training in which you put a goggle in one of those Meta or, you know, things that our kids play with. And you're getting trained in how to put out a fire, and it's a lesson using essentially gaming technology to give you a better way to do it. I mean, I think we're going to get there, and maybe down the road you'll see drones, you know, flying big water hoses into buildings, you know, 20 floors high. I mean, some of that is already happening. So what we're going to deal with, we got to catch up with the times. But we have to recruit volunteer firefighters because that's kind of there is a shortage of them. Yeah. And yet, every time that there is a disaster, from floods to fires to any kind of major situation, we really rely upon them. So my hat's off, you know, and I feel honored, you know, that NASM has asked me to help them out, right? And they'll have my time any day. And I told them, I don't want you guys to pay anything for what I do. You can count with me if you need me to help you, you know, establishing your advocacy or communication strategies, or how can we get your message out, count with my support. And that's really what I'm doing.
That's great stories there. I appreciate that. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, the GPA has both a national and local chapters, and a few of the local chapters have donated, whether it was equipment or money solutions, help them, you know, buy a new ambulance or new oxygen tanks or coats or whatever they were doing. But I'm pretty familiar with a couple local chapters that have kind of tried to help out in that way. So happy to hear that we're kind of going at it from a couple different ways. But as you were telling your stories and you've interacted with the public and these first responders and things like that, I was thinking to myself, when you were interacting with these folks, maybe during this crisis in Arkansas or other, maybe during a training, what's kind of the most surprising comments you get from those folks? I mean, do they really view it's that different, or are they surprised that we're doing this, or what's kind of the most surprising things you hear?
You know, I think a lot of what we deal with every day, the amount of change that is taking place in our lives, right? Not just technology, but, you know, the habits that we're forming, right? We rely more on podcasts like this to successfully get what we learn, right? And less so on the traditional media. I mean, they're struggling with that, right? The amount of, I mean, new materials that are being put in the marketplace, and what are the impacts that has? I mean, that it's something that they are changing. The gear, I mean, like right now, if you go meet with a first responder, they'll tell you, we need drones. Everybody wants drones. But those drones are going to be obsolete in less than 2 years because new drones are going to come up. I mean, now drones are in the battlefield doing huge things. Well, think about what they can do from safety, right? Aerial surveillance, the same thing. Air monitoring of all kinds of stuff. What you used to have, oh, to say, is there enough oxygen in the air? Now you can read an enormous amount of data. And the vitals that a firefighter has, the amount of technology and change and habits that is taking place is something that we need to pause for a second and say, you know, we're not going to stand in the way of progress, but we definitely need to commit to doing it as safely as we can every single time, the first time, and moving forward. So that, for me, is, you know, a wake-up call to all of us, right? And, you know, if there's anybody from my peers in industry, I would say this is, look, training is key. Before you give a grant to the next fire department that is next to your pipeline route, you know, check on the reports that industry gives you if they're taking the pipeline emergency response training and say, listen, for me to give you the grant, you need to complete that training because right now there is about 20 of you in that department that haven't completed the online training and I get the data. And if something happens, I'm going to be told you knew that they were not trained and you keep giving them gear. Training is key. Gear is great. Drones are great, right? But train them on how to respond to the products that you're moving and that they will be asked to respond if something goes wrong. So, you know, as good as everybody tries to be, right, I think there are some preconditions on safety that we all need to keep in place. And that is, we need to make sure that the learning, the amount of information that is required, does it well. And it doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to invite you to a barbecue and we're going to have a safety talk and all you do is go eat and pick up a couple of flyers and, oh, yeah, everybody, oh, sign up. Yeah, if anybody audits me, here we go. That serves some purpose. But I think the bigger purpose is making sure you use data, live data, and say, okay, this is my pipeline route. Do 25 miles from the center line. How many folks have completed the training that is free, that is available online 24/7 on how to deal with emergencies? Right. And be accountable. You find out there's some departments that haven't, and some departments that have pretty much 75% new recruits. Make sure they take the training, you know, and use it as a carrot, right? You want to get the new gear? We'd love to give you the new gear. Take the training, then you get the gear. I mean, it's a win-win. I mean, people want to do the right thing, but sometimes we need to encourage. And so, yeah, I think everybody tries to do it, but I think we come to the point to understanding that, you know, incidents sometimes can define industry and hold it back, no matter how well people prepare for it. And so doing that extra work really pays off. And I think first responders yearn for that knowledge. They're big supporters of energy, let me tell you, huge supporters of energy. You know, they understand that what they do relies upon having the energy and the supplies they need. That's why when you talk to them about CO2, it's like, who's afraid of CO2? Look at all these tanks and fire hydrants. We have CO2 left and right. We know how bad it is. It's not the one that keeps us awake. Yeah. But there are more products coming ahead. I'll give you this. There's hydrogen coming next, right? There is liquid ammonia coming next. And I like to share a story, and I tell thee to a number of elected officials. You know, and I say this, you know, with all my heart. I said, look, 87 years ago, in a little town called New London, Texas, 300 kids perish one afternoon. And they perish because at that time, natural gas, right, could leak and it didn't have any smell, right? And even though for years we have known that we could put a smell, right, we always came up with the excuses of it's too expensive, it's not compatible, you know, it's going to be too complex to actually put it in. And it took 300 kids to die. Very regretful. And in March of 87 years ago, right, for suddenly, within less than 6 months, the entire industry had a markup. Right. And now we know that there is a leak of natural gas. You smell it, right? And you immediately do something about it. As we think of the next set of products that need to be launched, right? I'm hearing the same kind of argument. Oh, it's not compatible. Mark Captain doesn't play. Mark Captain is not the right one, right? It's going to raise the prices. I get it. But we don't have to wait for the next fatality for that to trigger the need. We can do it ahead. So I'm not telling you which product, and I'm not telling you what, you know, part of the business needs to do it. But I think we need to keep safety always at the very top. Definitely. Right. And we know how to do things, and it might be too expensive, but find a different way to make it more efficient. Right. I think the first person that can come up with something that gets added into either hydrogen or any of those things, right, is going to make a killing. Patent it, come up with a flavor, with a smell, sell it to everybody else. But it's the right thing to do.
It is the right thing to do.
Yeah, let's not make it rotten eggs. Let's make it something smell good.
I mean, I've heard some people say we can make one that smells like garlic. Go ahead. Right. We just need to come up with something that it triggers. Now, not all products need it. I'll be the first one to tell you, right? Some of them have their own product, and we can smell them far away, right? But there's some that are silent, you know, and they smell like nothing. So like natural gas, we added mercaptan. The next set of products, we need to find a way to help us, or monitoring devices that can help us identify quickly. I mean, the technology today, I mean, we can fly a drone into, you know, into a battlefield and target exactly what we need. We need to be able to do it for defense purposes too.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot for a second to what you're doing now. Do you want to tell the folks, you know, kind of what you're doing at Tapia Center and what that is all about?
Oh, I tell you, for me, that's one of those things that keeps me, you know, energized every morning. All right. You know, Richard Tapia is easily one of the most decorated scientists of our generation, you know, more than 50 years of rice. Right. And he made a career about making sure everybody has an opportunity to fall in love with STEM, with science, technology, engineering, to mathematics, you know. And about 20 years ago, I got to meet him when we were presenting him an award at the Kennedy Center on math and engineering, right? And I remember that, you know, at that time, we're like, well, you know, but Richard can be a little bit provocative. He can say things unfiltered, right? He provokes people to react. I go, what's so bad about it? We need people that provoke us to do something, right? We gave him the award, right? And I got to meet him, and my God, he's a person that has charisma, has personality, and he really cares about making sure anyone belongs in STEM. Anyone, no matter what background, no matter what part of the society you come in, you can fall in love with STEM. So when I moved to Houston here, you know, about 16, 17 years ago, I got in touch with him, and he said, Nicolas, I need you to start a center for me here at Rice, you know, to focus on the youth, and I want you to lead it. So slowly but surely, we started building something that resembles STEM camps. And I got to tell you, the last 7 to 8 years, we've trained nearly 5,000 kids across the U.S. on STEM. 3 years ago, when low carbon was becoming popular, we included a curriculum of explaining carbon management. Right? What is carbon? Why is that we need to capture CO2? Why is it that it is important? Because it's important that kids, that next generation, have a voice on the future of energy. I mean, part of what holds this industry back is a lack of understanding from the very consumers that we have about what we do. Mm-hmm. And I would say the next 10, 20 years are going to be critical for us to reach energy dominance. And I know that the United States is the dominant player in the world. But to have those ambitions reach to where we want to, a lot of education is to happen. Education about why reducing our carbon footprint. Let's make our industry so competitive, right, that we can show the world how to do this well, right? And I, you know, I'm pleased. The Tapia Center this year, this last summer, I mean, over 1,000 kids participated, educators participated too. Right. And the trickling down effect is significant because we came up with a little model that you can pretty much with vegetable oil, beans, pasta, can simulate injecting CO2 in a reservoir. And we want to make that science experiment almost as ubiquitous as the egg drop challenge that we did when we were in middle school. Every kid should have the opportunity to understand carbon management. And why is it important for us to be more responsible instead of just letting it vent? We have the technology to capture it, store it, and minimize that carbon footprint. And we can actually make money out of it. And we can actually lead the world in changing about how we can do that well. Think of it, right? 30 years ago, recycling was just at the very beginning stages, right? Capturing and managing CO2 is recycling in some ways. And many oil fields, we're going to have to inject CO2, which sequesters it permanently, to get more production out of it, right? But why not just inject it permanently and make sure less of that goes into the atmosphere? I don't think there's politics on this side. I think it just makes sense. The science is very clear, right? It's been done for decades safely. And I think sometimes we got to be objective, you know, in the sense of, do I want to be proactive in this side of the equation about doing the right thing? Or do I want to spend so much time arguing, oh no, this just extends the life of your industry, or he does this, or he... Listen, if it works, do it. One of the things that amazes me is that when we present this to young kids as early as fifth and sixth graders, first thing they say, it works? Yes. Ask the experts about it. Their reaction is, why are you waiting to get it done? Right? If it works, just do it. Next generation is instant gratification. They're used to buying something on Amazon Prime and bam, they want to deliver, you know, in the next window, next day or 6 hours or 1 hour away from now. They will tell you, if you can capture those emissions, do it. So I think this is nothing to do with politics. I think it has to do about doing the right thing, right? And making sure we take accountability for, you know, mitigating the amount of emissions that are going out, right? We do it in other parts. I think that in the way that we manage carbon, you know, starting through education and getting to know each other and the challenges that we had ahead are critical. You know, a good analogy that I use is, look, education needs to take us into the next stage, right? We are about 5 years removed from COVID, the largest pandemic we've ever had. Do you think we're better off in understanding the value of vaccines or not? And I just, hey, look, I want to take politics out. Science is a science.
Yeah.
Let the doctors tell us. I don't think we're better off. And I think we need to be conscientious that for us to better understand some of the challenges ahead, let's be proactive. Let's do our civic responsibility and educate and raise our awareness about why it is that we need to do what we need to do.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I tell you, I got four kids, right? And I think it's important that I raise them to understand their life and what they do, how is that things work, right? And have the values that I want to for them to have. I think everybody else wants to do the same thing. So I think our industry, right, and for that matter, our country, is yearning to better understand what does it mean to be energy dominance. And I think there is no doubt that we are the right player to do so. But domination comes also a sense of responsibility. And that responsibility is not just about safety, which is key. It's also accountability for making sure that we do it right. There's an element of make sure that we do it fair too. I mean, some of the new fuels are going to be very expensive. Can everybody afford them? Mm. Right? So we got to make sure that it is flexible enough that all society, most of society can really benefit from it. Right? So look, I think there are challenges ahead bigger than the ones that we've had, but we're blessed that prior generations have put us to where we are. It's up to us to elevate that discussion, that civic mindset about what is the right thing to do. And they're not easy challenges ahead, but we can do it well, and we can do it safely, and we can do it affordably and responsibly in years to come.
Yeah, this is great. Nick, appreciate the insights and the anecdotes. It's been fun to talk with you. Just here as we get ready to close, anything else you're working on, any kind of desires you have as you've entered this next stage of your career?
You know, a lot of people, and I've shared to some folks, hey, I might run for office one of these days. You know, I'm going to do it the reverse. I'm not doing it to.
Do you need to announce anything today?
No, I'm not ready to announce anything.
That's right.
I'll tell you, one thing I've learned after having graduated from Big Oil is I'm enjoying my time, right? I'm enjoying my time in doing the things that I like to do and I feel most passionate about. The company, when I kept telling them, I want to retire. when the window opened that I could. But I think a lot of folks thought, oh, he's not going to. He's too young. He's in his early 50s. He's not going to do it. Even in trade, you know, and Stuart is laughing because he knows a lot of people, oh, he's not going to walk away. I said, yes, I am. And I did. And it took me about 2 or 3 months to finally wake up. And, you know, that first thought you have in the morning is, oh, my God, I got to do that report, or I got to do that, you know, audit, you know, thing coming ahead, or, you know, the first thought that comes to your mind. And think about it tomorrow morning. Okay. When you wake up and you kind of get a sense of where you are, what's the first thing that comes about? And it's probably work related, you know, something that is urging you to do. Now, when that happens, I'm like, you know what? I got to add an extra practice to my 11-year-old so he's ready for Little League coming up in the spring. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, hey, the Cougs are playing today. Let's go, Cougs. Yeah. Right? I mean, it's a different mentality. I'm not to say that you cannot balance it while you're working. I think you could, but it took me 2 months, you know, to finally have that shift. I'm enjoying that shift. Yeah. And the other day, somebody called me and I said, hey, we need your help. You know, would you consider coming back and working? And I'm like, I tell you, I'll help, no doubt, but I don't want to get paid.
Yeah.
I really mean it. Yeah. I said, I can help you. I'll sit down. I'll give you my counseling. And by the way, if you think I'm worth something because you're calling me, give a check to the Tapia Center or give a check to NASA. I'll make it very clear. I want a year, you know, to explore my options. Maybe that year decides for me to pay it forward and serve for the public good. But there's so many ways in which we can do it. You know, I almost feel like I'm too old to really go into the world of politics today because it can be pretty finicky. But I love to help, you know, and I'm very comfortable that I'm financially sound and I can take that luxury. But I planned it. I planned it so that when the moment came, right, I want to take some time to just do what I want. So if I want to dedicate my time just spending time with kids and talking about STEM and all the new technologies that are coming, like, for example, I'm excited that we're going to take the carbon module and explain to kids that that's what is going to feed this new data center explosion that is taking place throughout the country, which sucks a lot of electricity and we have to deal with water. But it gives them the AI that they are taking for granted and using every day, you know, right, as they use their tablets and phones and computers. So connecting what we've done in STEM, carbon management, data management, and eventually AI, I think is key, because unless we really do a heck of a job educating, that it just doesn't magically happen. The last part might require just a good programming and coding and boom, there you go. But to get there, somebody had to trek all the way to the far slope of the world, identify some gas, and find real engineering to extract it in a safe way, right, and then transport it, and then bring it to your house, right? Or to the power generation company that feeds the energy that you need. And all that requires a lot of data. So let's explain that, because it's not magic. It's real science and real technology that requires a lot of hard work by a lot of people. Right. And I think we need to take that seriously, because unless we take the time to explain it and educate the next generation, they're not going to get it. And we're going to get caught in the same situation that, oh, we're going to start talking about, let's solve climate change just by doing this. All those things are important. But let's take each step seriously and make sure that we build the support, because advocacy and community engagement are essential for our society to be successful. We need folks to understand what matters. And I mean, there's so many other things that we can educate folks. And my hat's off to educators. 4 kids going through school, let me tell you, hats off to those that have to help them. But you know, parents, we have a responsibility to complement that, if not lead that. Civic responsibility is, I would say, one of the top issues that we have had. And again, I try to not get into the political side, even though I might end up in the political side, who knows? But I think we all need to do our part. Just like in industry, we all need to do our part to do things safer, and we need to do our part to educate folks. And you guys are doing phenomenally in having a podcast that some people listen to. More and more folks are tuning in to see what are the viewpoints here. And I will say is, listen, educate yourself on the challenges that are coming up. And most importantly, pay it forward. Mm-hmm. Go teach the kids. about the challenges that we have ahead. Why is it important that we take some sacrifices here to get those sacrifices there, right? I love football. Okay. I wait all summer long to go. I love baseball too. Don't get me wrong. Okay. But football is such an American tradition. And here in Texas, you can't breathe unless you talk football. Right. And so it's a team effort.
Yeah.
Right. I love spending time with the coaches and seeing how they take things step by step. It's a process oriented. It reminds me a lot of our industry. You know, is you're not going to go from being the worst team in the league to being the first one in a matter of a year. No, it takes hard work and it takes a lot of coordination from folks to get it together. It's not one player that makes it happen. Right. I think we all have to find what place do we play? What position do we play? Not everybody's going to be quarterback. Right. I think every position is important. Some of them are going to be good kickers. And believe me, some games are won by good kicking, right? Did you guys see that 70-yard liner that somebody kicked the other day? My God, 70 yards. I mean, 70 yards, right? You just got to make it to the 40, and bam, you get 3 points. That's phenomenal. But what I'm getting at is everybody has a role, right? And it's a team effort, whether you are in your own sports team or whether you are in your own club, your church group, your school group, everybody has a role. I include folks. Make sure everybody feels like they're part of the effort, right? And I mean, look, coaches get what they get, right? Sometimes they get a lot of money and they can recruit better. Sometimes they get walk-ins and you get lucky, right? But you get what you get and you don't throw a fit. I was taught that from an early age, you know? You get what you get and you don't throw a fit. You try to make it better and you try to fine tune it, but be part of a team,
yeah.
Right? I think that helps in a lot of ways. You know, when people ask me, because I've had incredible teams, and they tell you the teams that I've led, you know, and that I was part of, I mean, very privileged. One factor that people ask me, what do you look for when you look for new talent? And I tell you, get along factor is top of the list. Yes, I want people with high integrity. I want people with good smarts, good grades, you know, good activities. But get along factor is absolutely essential, because not one person can do it all, you know. And find somebody smarter than you, but make sure that that person gets along with others, right? I would say that that's a trait that I used to tell folks I live by. Even to this day, I tell my kids, you know, whether you are an individual sport, playing tennis or golf, you're part of a team. Your get-along factors need to be great. Always, always. You'll have a bad day. You'll have a good day. In those bad days, get along. You know, you get back, you fix what you did wrong, and you take them to the next stage, right? If I have an opportunity to pay it forward and do that in a number of different ways, I mean, I'm 4 months into graduation, as I call it. I got 8 months to go. I might make it to a 1 year, but for me, getting along is key, and I hope that I can help others do the same thing. And I applaud you for doing your podcast, because it's about teaching folks and elevating the discussion and making sure everybody has a space. But I'm very energized about what's ahead.
Kind of answered our last question that we normally do for everybody as we're running up on time here. It's 3 years from now. You're back on our podcast. And you're happy, okay? What is going on over the past 3 years that has caused you to be happy?
Okay, the Cougs are playing for the national championship. I mean, we did it in basketball this year, right? We did it in basketball, but maybe in football, we're playing for the playoffs.
Yeah.
Right, that would make me happy. No, my kids, man, my family, right? Yeah. Everybody healthy, everybody growing. You know, my oldest is getting married next year. You know, my number two is getting a mechanical engineering degree from, you know, U of H next year, right? My little ones, you know, I mean, they're moving into high school, you know, and they're thriving. But most importantly, they're having a better, deeper understanding about their role, about their responsibility and how they fit, right? And I think as parents, particularly fathers, right, we take a lot of pride that we've done a good job in raising, you know, the next generation. So I take my job of being a dad probably as my number one job. And I've done that since the first one was born. right? I mean, I have a great partner. My wife has been with me for 30 years, right? I mean, I got to be a great husband too, right? Yeah. But being a good citizen, being a member of your community, making sure that we always ask to do better than what we did before, you know, in forums like this or in our churches or in our, you know, community gatherings, I think it's key. So in 3 years from now, yeah, I would love for my Astros to get another World Series. Yeah. And I would love for the Cougs to go to the playoffs. Right. But I would love my kids to succeed in everything that they want to succeed. Wow. And being part of who they are and, you know, making sure that they are contributing to, you know, our communities and our country as best as they can in the world that we live in. Right. I tell them, listen, travel. You know, I came from a third world country. I was born in Nicaragua and I was very fortunate to be here in the United States and be able to take advantage of the great opportunities. You know, I owe it to this country for me to pay back. So I see my next 3 years as I want to be somewhere when I'm paying it forward and just lifting those that might need more help and helping all of us to get to better places, right? I do want, you know, cleaner fuels in our industry. I want safer technologies implemented, right? So if I'll be privileged to have an opportunity to help in that front, it will be for the right reasons, which is I want to do it not because I want to ambition for something else. I want to do it because I feel privileged that I've been giving a lot and it's time for me to pay it.
That's awesome. Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Really appreciate your time and excited to learn about you and hear what's coming up next. And Stuart, got any wrapping thoughts there?
No, this is great. Encouraging, inspirational, awesome conversation. Thanks, Nick.
Stuart, Adam, keep what you're doing, okay? We need more of this awareness and education. Thank you so much for the opportunity. See you guys in 3 years.
Perfect. Thanks, everybody. See you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.